I'll begin with the Gold Rush, which was an enormous immigration process. Of course, large numbers of those people were Americans, obviously, but they were coming into territory that at least nominally was not American territory. And that immigration rush, you know, numbered in the tens of thousands and had a profound impact on the people who lived on the land at that time. So I think beginning there and continuing forward, I think, is the most appropriate way to approach this topic.
Well, let's go back then to that in the late 19th century. And who was living here prior to the Gold Rush? And we'll talk a little bit about the impact on the Native Americans as a result of this mass immigration. But tell us a little bit about, just prior to the Gold Rush, who was the population who was living here? And then we'll talk a little bit about who came.
So the tribes, the dominant tribes in Colorado during that period were the Southern Cheyenne, Southern Arapaho, and the various bands of Utes in the mountainous regions. Other tribes, of course, passed through, but they were the most important tribes and the ones that the U.S. had negotiated treaties with, you know, beginning in 1851 and through the 1870s and then or 1860s and then, you know, by 1880 or so, nearly all three of those tribes had been expelled from the boundaries of what was then the state of Colorado. There was a tiny foothold for the Utes in southwestern Colorado, but beyond that, all the tribes had been expelled.
And who was then coming in? Who was part of that big immigration rush at that point?
You know, the initial wave overwhelmingly were native-born Americans from east of the Mississippi, certainly some Hispanics from the south. And there was, I should correct that and say that there was, you know, a fairly substantial Hispanic population in the south and south-central part of the state as well. They managed to maintain a foothold during this period and you know, later in the 19th century and in the 20th century, more Mexicans and Hispanics made their way into Colorado as well.
No, we often use the term... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
But I was just going to say, you know, early on, you know, from the beginning of the Gold Rush and the Civil War period and up until the arrival of the railroad, the vast majority of people coming to Colorado were native-born Anglo-Americans. But after that period, we see, you know, substantially greater influx of immigrants from northern and western Europe, later southern and eastern Europe. And it's really important to bear in mind when you talk about the historical context, that's critical because this period of history is witnesses, you know, a global migration and triggered to a large extent by the Industrial Revolution of the late 19th century. And certainly we see echoes of that here too. It's, I think, one of the great things about Colorado history is it's such a great mirror of the larger American experience. And that is certainly much of what we witness in the immigration history of the state.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the industries and what was attracting, what jobs were attracting people. Because we talk about the Gold Rush, but it wasn't just gold mining. There was a whole bunch of industries and supportive services that emerged. What were some of the main jobs that were being done by immigrants? And were there specific groups of immigrants doing certain jobs?
That's a really great question. So so gold and later silver mining, you know, the two of those combined as hard rock mining, defined much of the work in the mining regions of the central and southern Rockies. But it's also important to point out that the demand for coal in the state was nearly insatiable during this period. So there were large numbers of workers involved in coal mining as well. Many of those were British Welsh miners who were experienced in that field, but increasingly, as we get closer to the end of the 19th century, larger numbers of Italians, Croats, other immigrant populations were filling those jobs in the coal mines. They had that experience, and it was incredibly dangerous work. So was hard rock mining. But I think in terms of the danger to the workforce, coal mining may have been the worst. And, you know, it was immigrants who increasingly took on those high-risk jobs. But you're correct. There were other subsidiary industries related to mining as well, and the smelting industry, which, you know, had popped up in other parts of the state, was really concentrated here in Denver, and immigrant populations took on those very difficult and hazardous jobs in the smelters, and you can still see some of that in the neighborhoods and communities in the north and northeast of Denver, in Swansea and Globeville. That's where the two of the largest smelters were located, and that's where populations of Southern and Eastern Europeans gathered and built their communities, and, you know, by necessity had to live near their work, which was, you know, presented a health hazard in itself. Just living in the area, I mean.
Well, you spoke about the dangers that the coal miners faced when they were actually in the mines. They were also facing danger above ground. And we've talked a lot about the labor disputes and the coal mining wars when their people went on strike and then they were attacked and people were killed in various different mining labor disputes that happened around Colorado. So what were some of the policies that were implemented around some of these industries that were emerging at that time?
That's almost a topic in and of itself. The history of organized labor in Colorado is fraught and extremely complex, and certainly observations of or respect of workers' rights and worker safety, not just in Colorado, but really through much of industrialized America, there was a very low threshold or level of support for keeping workers safe. They basically were on their own hook, and organized labor in the form of the Western Federation of Miners or the United Mine Workers, had to fight extremely hard to establish even minimal levels of safety regulations in the mines, and that for the most part was a losing battle on the part of the workers and organized labor. And certainly you are correct that the intense labor disputes, you know, really the capstone of that, of course, being the strikes at Ludlow and the great, you know, Southern Coalfield Wars of 1913 and 1914, were much about that and just providing some base level of safety regulations to protect miners. And that... The little bit of protection that was provided was, you know, grudging, and only after really prolonged struggles, and in the case of Ludlow, you know, outright warfare.
We're speaking with historian Tom Thomas this morning on KGNU, and he's going to be doing a presentation coming up on Tuesday, January 17th at Chautauqua in Boulder on Colorado's immigration history, really starting with Colorado's gold rush back in the late 19th century and moving forward. And we're talking this morning on KGNU about the context now that we need to look at current immigration patterns. And we'll get to that in just a sec. But as we move up, Tom, we talked about the wave of immigration coming in and the different countries and that were represented in that immigration. But then we saw a real backlash happening in the early 20th century. Talk a little bit about some of that backlash. Well, I suppose it started in 1882. There was the Chinese Exclusion Act. That was a federal act. But what was happening in Colorado with Chinese workers and the discrimination that some of these immigrant groups started to face?
There was a substantial backlash against the small Chinese population in Colorado during that period. There had always been resistance to the Chinese presence in the U.S. Obviously, they were integral to the construction of the Central Pacific Railroad and the labor they provided in the California gold fields and other parts of the West. But I think this issue in particular echoes some of the angst we're seeing about immigration today. They were perceived by a majority of Americans as extremely foreign and bizarre, perhaps in some cases, and of questionable moral behavior, and we needed the labor, the perception that they were somehow so completely different to what was perceived as American continued to fuel prejudice against them. And I think when the value of that labor began to decline in the late 70s, 1870s, the pressure to expel them increased in intensity. There was an anti-Chinese riot in Denver in 1880, and you know, a substantial amount of violence ending only in one death. But the fact is, these populations expressed that kind of oppression and violence throughout many parts of the West, and certainly that the element of racial bias, outright racism, there's no point in sugarcoating it, led to the passage of the Act in 1882. So this issue of otherness, or, you know, the critical, if not existential, threat posed by many immigrant populations, we're hearing echoes of that today, has always been a part of this immigrant process. And I think that's, you know, the conundrum we as a country need to come to grips with. We've needed that labor force. We've always needed the labor force, or certainly in many critical periods of American history. But at the same time, that need for the labor force has brought with it an accompanying amount of angst about the way it would change the nature of the country, language, customs, you know, very profound doubts or suspicions about who these people actually are, these others from various locations, you know, in the minds of many were fundamentally anti or un-American, and therefore comprised in the minds of many, I think, a necessary evil. And when that need was no longer there, then you really begin to see the backlash against those populations.
Talk about the Ku Klux Klan and its rise in Colorado, and its rise then and its influence in state and local politics.
Oh, yeah. I would have said maybe a few years ago, that's such a crazy story, but, you know, it has some echoes here as well. The rise of the Klan in Colorado, again, mirrored a rise in the Ku Klux Klan nationwide in the early 20th century. And it's a different kind of Klan. As you know, the Klan that arose in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War was, you know, an out-and-out terrorist organization focused really solely on suppressing the newly won rights for African Americans in the South. And they resorted to any means whatsoever to achieve those ends. And they were so successful that by the end of Reconstruction in 1877, the Klan had effectively died out in the South. Their work was done. The Klan that resurrected in the early 20th century was more, their agenda was broader. It was not just about blacks, but it was about immigrant populations, Jews, certainly, Catholics, and a large number of the peoples who had immigrated to Colorado in the late 19th century were Catholics, including, you know, two of my great-grandfathers from Ireland. And this was about 100% Americanism, and foreign populations of any type were increasingly suspect. It was, the term white Anglo-Saxon, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant might well have its origin here. That's what was considered a truly American person. And as I said, Italians, Eastern Europeans, Russian Jews, German Russians from the steppes of Russia, Catholics of any stripe, were perceived as un-American, as essentially un-American, and increasingly unwelcome. And for that short period when the Klan dominated politics in Colorado, it was, the backlash against immigrants was profound. They burned a cross on my great-grandfather's farm in the early 1920s, a man who by that point had been in the United States for over 40 years. In many ways, the embodiment of the American dream, but that event punctuated the fact that, at least in the minds of many, he would never be an American, at least by the standards that he perceived it.
He was Irish, was he?
He was Irish, Irish Catholic.
So the Ku Klux Klan were targeting people of all backgrounds. It wasn't just African Americans or Asians or the groups that had really experienced the most discrimination on the part of the Klan. Who were they targeting here then in Colorado?
Catholicism was a target. Judaism was a target. So any native or immigrant populations associated with those religions were considered suspect and un-American, effectively. Their focus was pretty much on native-born Americans of Northern and Western European origin and of the Protestant faith. So their definition of what constituted an American was extremely rigid and tight.
We're speaking with Colorado historian Tom Thomas this morning here at KGNU in advance of a presentation that he'll be giving on Tuesday, January 17th at Chautauqua in Boulder on Colorado's immigration history. And Tom, you yourself have a huge background in Native American issues, being involved with the National Park Service and leading projects, including the Sand Creek Massacre National Historic Site in Southern Colorado. Earlier in the conversation, we talked about the displacement or the expulsion of Native American tribes when we saw this mass immigration coming in. That's very sanitized language, and I know that we often use those words and not really think about how we are in many ways then contributing to the sanitizing of history. It was absolutely devastating to the Native American tribes when we saw this mass immigration. Let's talk about it in unsanitized terms, exactly what happened to the Native Americans, and then we'll bring it forward to today about the legacy on Native Americans in Colorado from this mass immigration into Colorado in the Gold Rush.
Well, so going back to the initial ripples of the Gold Rush in 1858, from that period on, the pressure against Native Americans on the plains and later in the mountains was relentless. And, a series of treaties whittled down the areas that had once been granted to them under the 1851 Treaty of Fort Laramie, or the Horse Creek Treaty, as it is also known, chipped away at the lands that were granted to them by the U.S. government. And really, by 1869, the Cheyenne and Arapaho people had been completely expelled from the state. That's just over a decade. It's nearly light speed in terms of a historical process. And by the early 1880s, well, late 70s, the cries against the Utes had increased in intensity. Newspaper headlines ran banners that read, "The Utes must go." And after the so-called Meeker Massacre at the White River Agency in 1879, the pressure increased, and the Utes were ultimately expelled from the mountain and western regions of the state as well, with the exception of two tiny reservations in the southwest corner of the state. So I need to be completely clear on the true legal definition of ethnic cleansing, but it certainly looks like that. And certainly the publication of headlines saying the Utes must go, they're clearly targeting a particular group because of their tribal, cultural, and racial affiliations.
So when you use terms like expelled, does that mean they were forced off their land, that they were marched out of state, that they were killed? I mean, what exactly does that expulsion look like?
There were, a couple of armed engagements, and the Utes, fought pretty effectively early on to hold off U.S. forces, but obviously the deck was stacked against them. So there was some armed combat, but ultimately it was just the Utes were overwhelmed, and then. United States forces forcibly evicted them effectively from the lands that they had held under previous treaties signed in the late 1860s. So it was not a voluntary departure, let's put it that way. This was a forced expulsion of Indians from Colorado. So from 1858, when the state's Indian population totaled, certainly several thousands, until 1880, when they had barely a toehold left in the state, that was a very rapid process of taking over that land and expelling the native populations to, you know, almost 100%.
What is the legacy right now, as we're in 2017 here in Colorado, when we look at cities that were essentially built on land that was stolen from Native American tribes, when we're looking at industries that were built in the backs of immigrant populations that were then subject to awful discrimination? I mean, what is the legacy, as we are here in 2017, of some of these stories that we're talking about this morning?
That's a really great question, and one that I hope I'm able to answer successfully in the talk in a couple of weeks. But I think, to me, there are a number of elements to it, one of which is, you know, this conundrum of immigration in a very profound sense having been the lifeblood of the country. I mean, very few of us, with the exception of Native Americans, with the exception of Native Americans, all of us, from one generation or another, trace our descent from immigrants. We're all here because of that process. And it has been a tremendously constructive and positive element of American history. But at the same time, that same process has been the source of tremendous fear, anxiety, hatred, backlash. It's been a very complex or complicated struggle for Americans in many cases to come to grips with what immigration meant and the benefits it provided to American society and the ongoing perception that it is a risk and a threat to the republic. And certainly it's true that as the immigration process unfolded throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries, it is true that, you know, each successive population that made its way in the door, there was a tendency to pull the ladder up and resist, you know, the continued immigration of populations that they themselves considered foreign. So I think as we go forward, from this point on in the new administration and beyond that, you know, finding a way to reconcile those two perspectives and recognize that we are a nation of immigrants and will continue to be a nation of immigrants, and how to make that process work constructively and avoid the backlash we've seen before, that's going to be a great political challenge for the country, a cultural challenge too.
And from your own personal reflections as an historian who's used to looking back and looking at these phases and these trends that have emerged. I mean, we talked about the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. Did you ever think there would be a time in modern history, modern day, that we would see the Ku Klux Klan or white supremacy having some type of influence on current politics?
You know, honestly, if you had asked me that question, I've got to think for a second. I think for the most part I would have said unlikely, but I would not have ruled it out. It's been too much an undercurrent of the American experience to say no, that we are in some post-racial or post-prejudicial period. I think, we were still fighting the same battles to a large extent in the post-World War II period during the Civil Rights era. The rise of the Chicano movement in the 1960s and 70s. I think if I'd really stopped and thought about it deeply, I would have said, no, there's always that potential in America. And so coming to grips with that reality and that, you know, that undercurrent of resentment or fear or hatred and the potential for that backlash is something we've got to get our hands around, and I'm not sure how to say this exactly, but maybe it comes down to a new way of defining what is an American. We've sort of had that redefined recently in a very narrow sense, and maybe it's incumbent upon us to look at this in a more holistic fashion.
And can we learn from history?
Well, We can, certainly. All the evidence is there. It is more a willful ignoring of the lessons of history that continues to create problems for us. Winston Churchill said that Americans can always be counted upon to do the right thing after first eliminating all alternatives. To a certain extent, we see that process here. We've struggled with the immigrant process at the same time that we've welcomed it and used it to the nation's advantage. And but the undercurrents of that fear and resentment and sense that someone new is taking what is rightfully yours, that we've not moved past yet.
Well, people can learn a lot more about Colorado's immigration history by attending a lecture given by my guest, Tom Thomas, at Chautauqua in Boulder on Tuesday, January 17th at 7 p.m. It kicks off a monthly history series looking at regional and local history, and we'll be checking in with other presenters throughout the year. But in the meantime, people can find out more at chautauqua.com, and we will link to that at kgnu.org. But I'd like to thank my guest this morning, Tom Thomas, historian. Thank you very much for being with us.
I want to thank you very much. It's always a pleasure.